First of all, this year is dedicated to the memory of Avraham Pinchas and Yehuda Argezal by Yehudit Ben Menachem. Anyway, this year should be Le'ilui Nishmat Avraham Pinchas by Yehuda Argezal. Okay? That's one. Number two, the Rambam says, that tshuva shlema, the epitome, the apotheosis of tshuva is when you find yourself in the same position as you were at the time that you did the Aveda, and instead of doing the Aveda, you do the right thing. That is tshuva shlema. Mr. Gorman gave me last week an announcement to make, a very important announcement. And I went straight into the shiur. My head was so much in the shiur that I just forgot about it. And then after, I love to wallow in guilt. Don't stop me. And I didn't make the announcement. I can make the announcement this morning because it's about an event that's going to take place here at the center tonight at 8:30. There are going to be two people from 8:30. Did I what I say?
No.
I don't know. It says 8:80. Now there is no 8:80 nowhere in the world. So I didn't know whether it was supposed to be 8:30 and they wrote 880, or it's supposed to be 8, and the 8 is a 0. You know what? Let's not split cards. 8 o'clock tonight, there are going to be two residents of Migron that are going to be here and are going to give you the whole story behind Migron. Migron is the yeshuv in the Shomron that is now at the top of the news. I don't understand. I can't understand anything. Why any Jew would want to take down a Jewish settlement in Eretz Yisrael? I'll never understand that. But anyway, according to the Supreme Court, Migron is supposed to go down at the end of the month. It seems that there are now possibilities of a compromise, and it may be that the compromise has been accepted, but it's important to know all of the information behind it. It's good to know, and it's worthwhile, and we have to, I have to say, I suggested last week to somebody who wanted to give tzedakah to give it to the struggle for Migron, which I did. They gave me the money and I gave it, so there will be a presentation of it. All right, the shiur. Today's shiur is on an ancient problem. It's Parshas Mishpatim. Now, it's also going to be Parshat Shkolim. Now, usually when it's Parshat Shkolim, that already sends a shiver down one spine. It's because if Shkolim is here, Pesach is around the corner. So then there are always two possibilities. One possibility is you have to start cleaning the house and you have to start earlier. Or you have to start buying the wardrobe and packing the suitcases to go away to a hotel. And I'm not sure which one of the two is more difficult. Anyway, the important thing is the Gesinta Haid, we should have a beautiful Pesach over here, but before that, we still have to go through Purim, Gesinta Haid. We're coming, Misha, Nechlis, Adam, Rabban, the Simchah, this coming Shabbos, since it's Shkolim, is going to be Shabbos Mevorchim. The following week, I think it's Thursday and Friday, will be Rish Chodesh, and that's it. We're on the way. I don't know where the winter went. Tomorrow I'm going to be asking myself, what happened to the week? The weeks go so quickly. So we have to make sure that we make use of every day. The topic for today is probably a topic that one will be able to talk about for who knows how long. Ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye. An eye for an eye. I have a feeling that, I always seem to find something in the news on Tuesday morning that has something to do with this year. So, of course, I went digging through the Jerusalem Post this morning, and there's a big article about a controversy someplace, I think. I don't know where, it's here. Yeah, someplace. I don't get things straight when I go through quickly. A question of the Merchant of Venice. Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice has come onto the scene again. I think they're going to have it here. But wherever it's shown or wherever it's played, there are always those who are going to say it's anti-Semitic. You can't. Whatever it is, of course, most probably Shakespeare was inspired by an eye for an eye. Otherwise, why would this Shylock think that he can make a deal with Antonius? Was it Antonius or Polonius? Or the connection is terrible. That he'll cut his heart out if he doesn't pay him back the loan in time. So Shylock has been for all time, it's been the classic anti-Semite Shylock, even though the speech that Shylock makes over there about a Jew is also a human being is a fascinating piece of literature. Fascinating piece of literature. But all right, it all flows from Ayin Tachat Ayin. In other words, Jews, Torah says you take an eye out for an eye, and a yard, a hand for a hand, and a foot for a foot, a burn for a burn, a bruise for a bruise. So how do we understand it? Of course, I wouldn't ask anybody in Saudi Arabia, because in Saudi Arabia, that's exactly what they do even today, in the year 2012. And nobody gets shook up about Saudi Arabia, but about Jews that we will see never for a moment in all of history ever practiced an eye for an eye. To us, they have their complaints an eye for an eye. So we're going to see what does the pasuk really mean, and not only what the pasuk really means, if we are going to decide that the pasuk means something else. Why indeed did the Rabbeinu Shalom write in his Torah, Ayin Tachat Ayin, an eye for an eye, which can be misunderstood? But we're also going to see it can only be misunderstood by somebody who doesn't really know how to read a Pasuk Chumash. You need a little bit of training in how to read the Pasuk. I hope by the time the shiur is over, you will see how you're supposed to read that Pasuk. Ayin tachat ayin and eye for an eye. But let's begin with the following. I remember yet the days. I remember seeing them. It's right in here. It must have been in the 60s or the 70s when there were raids or attacks by the Israeli army against terrorist bases. So I remember seeing it in Time magazine, an eye for an eye, Old Testament vengeance, Israeli planes bombed, Jezets, knock, shot, bomb, So of course, one thing you always have to remember, that there's a difference between two words in English can take care of it all. People confuse retaliation with revenge.
What is retaliation?
If somebody hits me and I hit him back, that's retaliation. I am going to the source of the terrorism, the pain, the attack. What happens if somebody attacks me and I go beat up his son? That's revenge. But if If we go out against terrorist bases, that's Old Testament vengeance, an eye for an eye. Sinishkan, an eye for an eye. But the same mistake that they make in not understanding the difference between retaliation and revenge, it's the same kind of mistake that they make in the reading of an eye for an eye. So, let's go. What's also important over here is there's a terrible mistake that can be made. I've seen it. People who definitely make that mistake. And my mistake is that the Torah meant an eye for an eye. Literal. But with the passage of time, people became more humane. People became more sensitive to the pain of others. And the rabbi saw that can't really take out an eye for an eye. So with their heightened sensitivity, with their compassion, they reread and they reinterpreted the pasuk. In other words, halacha evolves, it develops. What the halacha once was, it's not today. We don't believe that. Don't get me wrong for a minute. We don't believe that. We're going to see that we believe that the halacha, exactly as it was given at Sinai, was. Ayin tachat ayin means paying the value of an eye for putting out somebody else's eye. It never for a single moment meant anything different than that. But I saw in a sefer that was recently published by a friend of mine who lives on my block, and you know, I've had a number of serious debates with him on the street, on our gossip. You know, that's where. That's my turf, or I think it's my turf. One of the editors of Mishpacha magazine, Moshe Krilak, he writes the lead article over there, and we sometimes disagree. We sometimes disagree violently. So here he put out a very nice paper about revelation at Mount Sinai. The revelation at Mount Sinai, he says that, you know, he collects a whole bunch of articles that were written by different people over the years, and the purpose of it all is to establish quite clearly that revelation at Mount Sinai is a fundamental principle of Torah. You have to understand what it means is that both Torah Shebaktav and Torah Shebaal-Peh, the written law and the oral law, were all given to Moshe at Sinai. And exactly the way it was then, that's what we keep to today. So one of the articles, and this happens to be an article that he wrote, is about an eye for an eye. Now, you understand, of course, that I don't want to get into this now because it will get me upset, but there was an article last Friday in the Jerusalem Post about revelation at Mount Sinai, that it's an ongoing, evolving, developing process. Of course, I had to take a shot of schnapps before Shabbos in order to make my way through Friday. Torah given at Sinai is not an evolving, developing process. Torah is fixed as it was given at Sinai. But of course, rabbis have the right to add or to enact as they see fit. But Torah is immutable. Never changes. Throughout all time, it will never change. And that's what we believe. That's what we believe. So he writes a nice article, you know, if I disagree with people, sometimes I like to say, I did something good. Wrote a nice article about Ayin Tachat Ayin. And he says the following. His opening comment is that if we're going to say that the Torah meant Ayin Tachat Ayin means an eye for an eye, literally, then the rabbi's compassionate, humane, decent individuals decided that they have to change the Ayin Tachat Ayin. And because of their humanity and their compassion, they did it. Why did they only decide to be compassionate about this halacha? There are other halachas in Torah. There's a halacha that lo yavo mamzer b'kahal Hashem. a mamzer is not permitted to marry into the fold. Why is this poor kid guilty for the transgression of his parents? Couldn't the rabbis have shown a little bit of pity, mercy, compassion, feeling, understanding, and have lifted this terrible ban from the mamzer? I mean, there are all sorts of other things, you know. If a woman has to go, if her husband died and she had no children, she has to go through a process of Yibum, and if not the Yibum, then there's the ceremony of Chalitza. Not a very pleasant kind of ceremony to go through. Well, what was their problem? Why couldn't the rabbis do something about this? And of course, more than anything else, there's a law in Torah that says you're not allowed to leave any of the seven nations in Israel. You're not allowed to leave them alive. You have to destroy them utterly. And Amalek you have to destroy. Compassionate rabbis, do something about it. Your only compassion is for the rare case where somebody may blind somebody else's eye, so you don't take out his eye. Obviously, we're not talking about compassionate rabbis who a thousand years after Torah was given decide that they're going to make changes. There were no changes that were made. There were absolutely no changes that were made. These three words, ayin, tachat, ayin, and I'm not even ready to translate it yet. An eye for an eye, but we don't forget what it means. The way these three words are understood by the world, the way they understand it, it paints a picture of cruel, brutal, and inhumane code of law authored by a god of wrath and anger, exacting inhumane punishment that benefits no one. No forgiveness, no compromise, strike back, maim, cripple the guy who did it. So now, since we know that the rabbis modified the Bible and ruled that one pays money, so we ask, why didn't the rabbis go ahead and worry about the other halakhos in Torah? The superficial, mistaken undertaking of this pasuk has fed and nurtured Jew hatred throughout the generations ad hayom hazeh, until today. They didn't understand what the pasuk means. They didn't understand how to read the pasuk. And of course, humane Christians and Muslims, Mechleimish, you understand, humane Christians and Muslims, with their humanity and their compassion and their religion of love, you understand, with their brutal benevolence, have killed more Jews than ayin tachat ayin, that never hurt a soul in all of history. Now, Jews that are not exposed to the way in which Torah has to be read and understood have difficulty with the pasuk. But we're going to make sure that you don't have that difficulty. But with a closer look, and only in that way can we truly understand the pshat in any pasuk. I'm involved in an ongoing debate, controversy, and with someone, and I get the feeling, boy, I'm convinced he doesn't know how to read a pasuk chumash. My tafkid over here, my task is to teach you how to learn a pasuk chumash. Well, so let's read the tzuvim. Let's go. Let's get down to business. And watch, very interesting. I'm going to start a few psukim before Ayin Tachat Ayin. Number one, V'chiyidivin Hamashem V'hikorish Et Re'enu Be'evin O Be'egrov. Watch this. This is fascinating. If men are going to quarrel and one strikes his fellow with a stone or a fist, And he does not die, v'lo yamut v'nafal l'mishkav, but he, they translate it as falls into bed. Is that a good translation? He falls into bed. No, he falls into bed, not the cheek.
He's laid up.
He's laid up, yes, he's laid up. In Yakum Yitaleh Bachutz HaMishamto, the Torah says if he gets up and goes about outside under his own power, Al Mishanto, the Nikoh HaMakeh, so the one who struck him is innocent and is absolved. Rak Shifto Yitain V'Rako Yirapeh. In other words, talking about somebody, Reuven struck Shimon. Remember, Reuven struck Shimon intentionally because these two people were having a fight. Uh-huh. And in a fight, people strike one another intentionally. Okay? Whatever. The only thing is, there's no permanent damage. The only thing is that Shimon is laid up for a while. He needs to be, he loses a few days of work. He also has to pay for doctors. And then Reuven, the striker, has to pay for the doctors and unemployment. Okay, very good.
If a man is going to strike his manservant or his maidservant with a stick, with a rod,
and he dies under the hand of the master, not Kongi, not Kane. Vengeance, he shall fully be avenged. But if he lingers for a day or two, then there is no payment to be made, but we're not going to go into that. That's a whole shiur in and of itself. Now, here comes another case where people are struggling, another fight. Another fight is going on, the Chiyinotzwa Anoshim. People are straight, if men shall fight. Now, here I like the English. In the first case, it says if men quarrel. Mm-hmm. It says if men fight. The difference between the first case and the Torah is nobody had any intention to kill the other. In the second case, it's a fight to the death. And these two people are fighting with one another. V'nofu isha hora, and in the course of their struggle, an innocent bystander is the one who is hurt. It's a pregnant woman. V'nofu isha hora, v'yotzu yoladeh, and she loses her child as a result. She miscarries. V'lo yiyosom, nobody dies. In other words, no full, no living being dies. The babies are not considered, they haven't been born yet, they're not considered live entities. So then, so the fellow who struck will have to pay, be punished as the court will decide. Watch. Okay? But what happens if there's going to be a tragedy, somebody's going to die? The Natata Nefesh Tata Nefesh, a life for a life. Ayin Tachat Ayin, an eye for an eye. Shen Tachat Shen, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot. A burn for a burn, a wound for a wound, a bruise for a bruise. That's Kriya Tachat Kriya, Petzah Tachat Petzah, Kabura Tachat Kabura. Let's assume for a moment that ayin tachat ayin means you take out one's eye. For a moment. Now, in this second case where the two are struggling with one another, serious battle is going on. But the one who's hurt was hurt unintentionally. A third person bystander is the one who has been hurt. That's really what happened in the second case. In the first case,
where two people are quarreling and one hits the other with a stone or with a fist. There was no intent to kill. There was no intent to maim. There's a struggle going on, and unintentionally, he caused his antagonist to be laid up in bed. Now, let's figure this out. Take a look what's going to happen here. But they were quarreling with one another, and he wanted to hurt him, didn't want to kill him. He did intend to hurt him. So what's the halacha where he intended to hurt him and therefore he's laid up in bed? The halacha is you have to pay. And it's clear. It doesn't say over here, lay him up for laying him up. It doesn't say over here, like, pay a doctor for nothing for his payment. In the first halacha, it's clear that we're talking about monetary compensation. Shtel zech for. Can you imagine what a strange thing it would be? That in a case where somebody wanted to strike somebody else, and he was laid up and he needed to pay a doctor, the halacha is that you compensate by paying money. How could the Torah possibly a few psukim later say that if you hurt somebody unintentionally, we're going to take your eye out? Is there ever a case where somebody who does something unintentionally is going to be punished more severely than somebody who does something intentionally?
Amazing.
Can't be. The first case is mazid, intentional. And there the halach is clear, you pay money. The second case of the Torah is where somebody, a third person is hurt, and that's clearly unintentional, and they even say, no, no payment. Take his eye out. Take his eye out. Put him to death. Chop off his heads. It's a brech head and feast. It's totally illogical. If you take a look at these two sets of psukim side by side, the dilemma is so clear. Torah could never have meant that ayin tachat ayin is literal. Because if it's literal, it would be saying that the one who caused injury unintentionally is going to be dealt with far more severely than the one who caused injury and damage intentionally. Can't be. That's one thing that you know right at the very beginning. Anybody who would take a look at the two parashot side by side, you'd have to come to the conclusion, wait, there's something wrong. It can't be that ayin tachat ayin means an eye for eye. This was unintentional. And if an intentional injury you pay for, then what would be the case over here? That's number one. Number two, let's take a look in the Rambam. That's number two, mamish. The Rambam says the following: a person who causes bodily injury to his friend has to pay five different payments. These are the five payments. Nezek is for the injury itself. Tsar, you have to compensate him for the pain that he suffered. Ripu, you have to pay for Dr. Bills and healing. Shevet, you have to pay him unemployment for the amount of time that he wasn't able to work. And Boshet, you shamed and embarrassed somebody. You beat him up in the presence of who knows what. You have to pay all these five things. Kulam ishtamim min ayofish ben chosav. Kedim kol mezikin, and here there's a special halacha that when you pay for damages, physical damage, you cause it somebody, you have to pay from. If you have a good field, if you're going to pay by land, a good field, a median field, and a bad field, you have to pay from the very best. That's the halacha of the Torah. All right. Now, let's go to Halachic Gimel. Zeh shenena b'Torah, that which it says in the Torah, kashe yitein mum ba'adam ken yinatein bo. This is a pasuk at the end of Parshat Amor. We're going to see the pasuk later. What it says in the Torah that as a man makes a blemish in somebody else, so shall be given to him, which could leave the impression that we do unto him what he did unto his friend. It doesn't mean that we are to go ahead and cause bodily injury to him just as he did to his friend. Ella, Rambam is making a very important point. He's beginning the first step in answering the question, if it doesn't mean to do bodily injury to him, if it doesn't mean that you have to exact the Shakespearean pound of flesh out of him, what did the Torah mean by saying that we should go ahead and take out his eye, or we should cause bodily injury to him? No, the Torah is making a statement, an ethical and a moral statement. You who did that to your fellow human being, roi l'chasro eiver, you know what? By right, that's what we should do to you. So you should feel the full extent of what you did because either intentionally or because of your negligence. Olach bol kasher osa elashu royal chasvei eiver. He is worthy that we should remove that organ of his body, or that we should cause him bodily pain or injury as he did to his fellow. Therefore, but we don't do that. Mishal in Yisko, he has to pay. Vareinu Omer, because it says, Lo tikku kofa l'nefesh rotseach, l'ripseach b'l'vachim shein ben kofa, avu l'chesel l'nuforim, o l'chavolet yesh bo kofa. It says in the Torah, you can't take money from a murderer. If he wants to buy, he wants to ransom his life, he'll pay. Torah says, well, tikhu kofer, you're not going to take any ransom, the nefesh rotseach, for the soul, for the life of a murderer. But if the Torah says you're not allowed to take money for the life of a murderer, but you could take money from somebody who only caused injury. A murderer cannot ransom himself from the death penalty, that says it literally in Torah. Which obviously leaves the impression, but what happens if Reuven didn't kill, but Reuven maimed, Reuven caused injury? For that we can take money. V'chein zeh shenemar, next halach, halach adalot, v'chein zeh shenemar v'chogol v'chaveri or mazik, or that which it says by a person who causes injury or damage to his friend, lo tachos einecho, that you shall not have compassion. It means, it doesn't mean he shouldn't have compassion on him and blind his eye or cut off his hand or foot. It means you should not be compassionate with regard to the amount of money that he has to pay. Shema, maybe you'll say this fellow Reuven who caused injury to Shimon, only he's poor. And he really caused this injury unintentionally. You start becoming a bleeding heart, literal, can't go ahead, and now you can't do that. He really didn't mean it. Arachamenu, I'm going to have mercy on him. He's poor, he didn't mean it. Lekachnema, therefore it says, lo tachos einecho. That's misplaced compassion and mercy. Save your compassion for people who truly deserve it. A fellow caused damage or injury to somebody else, intentionally or unintentionally, every human being is responsible for what he does. And if he did something wrong, he has to pay for it. We exact the punishment from him. Don't become merciful. Save your mercy for the people who truly deserve it. Minayin, next halacha, shezeh shenama beivarim ayin tachat ayin tashlu minhu. The Rambam asks the great question, how do we know when it says an eye for an eye, how do we know that means that you should pay? Ayin tachat ayin sounds clearly, it means like an eye for an eye. Shenama bo, chabura tachat chabura, it also says a wound for a wound. Ubefeirish dema, befeirish it says in Torah, v'chidakei ish et reyehu be'evan be'egar, if somebody is going to strike his friend with a stone or with a fist, rak shifto yitei v'rapo yiratei, that's what we started with in the beginning. What does it say? What does it say when you cause injury? You didn't cause loss of a limb. You caused injury, you pay. You pay for his being unemployed, and you pay for his medical bills. Holamadata, listen to what he's saying. From here you learn, this is a very important statement the Chacham has made. Holamadata, from this you learn, Shetachat, Shenemar, Bechaburo, Tashlumen. What did it say in that first case? Did you pay? You know what that comes to tell us? That when it says chabura, tachat chabura, or ayin, tachat ayin, what it really means is payment. Just like you have to give only payment in the first case, and remember, we also pointed out that that first case was a case of intentional harm. V'hu adin l'tachat ha'amur ba'ayin u'bishari harm. It means that the word tachat, wherever it appears, means payment. Not the eye for the eye, compensation for the eye for the eye. But we're going to go much further with regard to this. Halacha bach, that's it. V'achal pi shedvorim elu nidin me'inyin torish ha'baktav, even though we can see the meaning of ayin tachat ayin, that it means financial compensation. We can see it. If you read the Torah Shabbatav, if you read the Pesukim carefully, you'll be able to see that. The kulam neforoshin hendefi Moshe, that this was the halacha, was all of them were explained by Moshe, that's what it means. At Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai, there's no evolution, there's no development, there's no waiting around for 1,000 or 1,500 years until compassionate rabbis come along and change the law. This was the law from the first day that it was given, and that's how it was understood by Klal Yisrael. Kulam halacha the Moshe hang, all of them are halacha that was given to Moshe b'yadeinu, which in our hands. V'chazer rav avoteinu donim b'beitino shel Yoshua u'beitino shel Shmuel haramati. Any case of this sort that came to Yehoshua, who received Torah from Moshe, if it came to the Bezdin of Shmuel from Ramah, all of them, there was never a time in Jewish history where an eye or a hand or a leg were taken for an eye, a leg, or a hand. U'bechol betin u'betin sh'omdu Moshe Rabbeinu v'adasho. Every betin from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu until today, everyone always exacted punishment. Never anything else. So there's no evolution of halacha over here. We are not talking about Old Testament vengeance that have to be modified and made more palatable by the rabbis. Nish emes, it's not so. There never was a moment in Jewish history that an eye for an eye ever was meant to be taken literally. But we're going to go, we have a lot more to do yet over here. I don't know how we're going to pull all of this off, but how many sheets do you have? Huh? So somebody's nice to me, give me three. Let me see. Okay. Not important. One, two. Now we're going to number three. Number three is that Be'ilam Mishpatim Hashetosim Lefneihem? That's the beginning of the parasha. Be'ilam Mishpatim Hashetosim Lefneihem. Yes.
How does this differ, is it the same
as... A little louder. How does this differ, or is it the same as mido keneged mido? Measure for measure, mido keneged mido. You know who has to decide mido keneged mido? He's the one in his punishment. He's the one who has to do measure for measure. Because he's the only one who knows how to give measure for measure. And therefore,
somebody who kills intentionally, there's no way that a Beit Din here can ever forgive him. God will do tshuva, God will ultimately forgive him. But no, we have to follow the law as the law is. Measure for measure is for God, not for us. So there's a beautiful Rav Shamshon of Ol Hirsch that's just, I want you to know it because it will explain a great deal. It will explain a great deal. The parasha begins with, these are the judgments, the laws that you should place before them. Okay, here it is. Jewish law is beginning. Okay? And of all things, do you know what the first law is? The law of somebody who buys a Hebrew slave. And then the law of one who purchases a Hebrew maid servant. Like one could, you know, you could sort of think to yourself, is this the most important law that we have to know at the very beginning? If anything, this is an exceptional law. Not everybody had slaves, and the whole story of everything that happens with the slave, this is highly exceptional, unusual. This is the first halacha that you tell us. So Rav Shamshon of Ol Hirsch says the following. It's a beautiful idea, and it explains so much in Torah. And that's the following. The book, I'm going to tell you where we need to read right away. It says the following. Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain, and he, one of two things could have happened. He says, okay, chavre, ayin tachat ayin. So one of two things could have happened. Rebbe, do you really mean an eye for an eye? I'll tell you what the Rebbeinu told me. The Rebbeinu told me, you pay for the value of an eye. Wait, so why is the Rebbeinu writing it that way? He's writing it that way because he wants to tell you that you caused bodily harm to somebody. That's serious stuff. And you know by right what should have been done to you? We should let you feel what you did to somebody else. But we're never going to do that to you. God is compassionate and understanding. No, we're not going to take out your own. By the way, Moshe most probably told him, and what benefit will that fellow have if we take out your eye? But what happens if we're going to make sure that you make up that loss to him? Well, that's going to be a completely different story. There's no such thing as just, we're going to take revenge, vengeance. Nobody gains from it. Instead of having one person without an eye, we now have two people without eyes. No. That means like this. From the moment that Jews learned, were taught the halacha by Moshe explained it. Can you imagine what happens when he tells him you have to wear tefillin? So what do you think? He just told him, listen, you have to wear tefillin. No. He told them what they look like, and he told them that you're going to have to write four parashas of Torah, and you're going to have to put it into this black box, and they're going to be a black box here, and a black box here. Here it's one box, here it's four box. Everything was explained to them. They knew every halacha from the moment that it was conveyed and communicated to them. Rav Shamshon of Ol Hirsch is going to say the following. You ever ask somebody, to borrow their notes from a lecture? You weren't at the lecture. You couldn't make it to the lecture. Okay, you went to the ball game. You want to get the lecture. You want to get the shiur. There's stuff there that you're not going to understand because the only one who understands it is the one who wrote it. And then, you know, when we write notes, exclamation marks, we underline certain words, we highlight certain ideas. The person who wrote it understands it very well. The moment he sees that exclamation mark, that's what the professor said. He sees the question mark, he knows what it means. He sees something underlined, he knows what it means. Torah that was given to Klal Yisrael at the end of 40 years were the notes of the lectures that Moshe Rabbeinu gave for 40 years. Klal Yisrael lived it for 40 years in the desert when they opened up Parashas Mishpatim
and they came to Ayin Tachat Ayin, they knew exactly what it meant. There was never any doubt in their mind. Not for a moment. Oh, everybody, 600,000, 3 million Jews, know exactly how Moshe Rabbeinu had said Pshat in it. For them, the words of Torah were the notes of lectures that they had sat in, that they wrote, that they understood, that they knew everything. There were no doubts. One word. Moshe Rabbeinu says, when you want to eat an animal, the zavachta, you should shecht it. Shecht? What's shecht mean? You don't know any halachas there on Hilchos Shechita? You kidding me? There's so much vast body of literature. That vast body of literature didn't go into Torah. That vast body of literature was communicated orally by Moshe to the Jewish people. They knew exactly what the word meant. Somebody who wasn't there didn't have a clue. We have received it all in an unbroken chain of transmission. Moshe Kibbutz Torah Sinai, Umesor Yoshua, down all the way down to this very day. So therefore, when there's a pasuk that seems to be difficult to understand, it may be difficult to understand to us or for the uninitiated, but for anybody who learns Torah the way it should be learned, as the Rambam said here, never, never was there ever a moment in Jewish history when an eye for an eye ever meant anything aside from pain. So let's go through a little shamshin of Frau Hirsch. The book, second line, the book is only, that's the Torah scroll, is only to be an aid to memory and reference when doubts arise. If, as indeed is stated in the book itself, the total and complete law had been given over to the people in its complete form and had been impressed upon them and explained to them and lived by them for full 40 years before Moshe, just before his death, was to hand them this written book. But they had lived it, studied it, knew it, reviewed it for 40 years. Then we can well understand that it is just the exceptional cases which principally come to be described. Now he says, now you can understand why Moshe Rabbeinu begins when he writes it. He writes the story of Eved Ivri, the Hebrew slave. That's an exceptional, unusual case. Because all of the usual cases, everybody knew that. And the exceptional is being told to us, possibly for the idea that you have to understand a slave is also a human being. A slave has to be treated with decency and with respect. The slave does not see the unusual and the exceptional halacha that can establish for us the principles. Let's go. So that just from them, the normal general principles of justice and humanity may be more strikingly realized. Then we can understand how it is the general principles of justice are altogether not so much given in this book. General principles are not even given. All of those were transmitted to the Jewish people. But preferably, you know what Torah wants to give us? Single concrete cases. And these are described in the book, the Sefer Torah, in such an instructive manner that the principles which underlie them and which had been entrusted to the living minds and living practice of the people can easily be seen from them. Then we can understand how the language used in this book is so skillfully chosen that often by the use of a striking expression, an unusual or altered construction, the position of a word. By the position of a word. There are so many seemingly little things from which we learn so much. Because remember, these people knew it all, and the book is there only to remind, so that they recall. A whole train of ideas of justice and human rights is indicated. After all, it was not out of this book that the law was to have been acquired. They didn't learn Torah from the book. They learned Torah from Moshe. And by the way, that's why the Torah wanted that in the real sense, Torah should be taught Baal Peh. Torah taught Baal Peh means that you are taught by a Rebbe. A living Rebbe teaches you Torah. A Rebbe that you can ask, a Rebbe that you can communicate with, a Rebbe who's there to explain, to elaborate, make things clear. That was the optimum way for Torah to be transmitted. And only when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi around the year 200 saw that system was not going to survive, he made the decision to write the Mishnah, and after him Ravina and Ravashi decided to write the Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan Rish Lakish Talmud, the Yerushalmi. All of this was done because we couldn't keep to the optimum. Jews were being batted from pillar to post throughout the world. There was no people living on their own land with continuity and with a sense of peace and tranquility. It all had to be written. But the optimum way to teach Torah is a Rebbe sitting in front of you. You can, even by the look on his face, the way he expresses something, there's so much that you can learn from it. Look at the next paragraph. The Torah should have promised to be to the Torah Shabbat in the relation of short notes. This is what I told you. The Torah Shabbat, the written Torah, in its relationship to the Torah Shabbat, the oral law, is in the relation of short notes on a full and extensive lecture on any scientific subject. For the student who has heard the whole lecture, short notes are quite sufficient to bring back afresh to his mind at any time the whole subject of the lecture. For him, a word, an added mark of interrogation or exclamation, a dot, the underlining of a word, is often quite sufficient to recall to his mind a whole series of thoughts. For those who have not heard the lecture, they're going to come to ayin tachat ayin, an eye for an eye. Hey, Old Testament vengeance. This is a wrathful and angry God that was never so for Klal Yisrael. Let's go to number. I'm running very, very. I don't know. This may have to go into extra innings, but we'll still take. I'll take one other example right now. I haven't really explained the Ayin Tachat Ayin yet, so. Baruch Hashem, we'll have many. Sure. There's one other misunderstood word in Torah. One other word that simply is not understood. And if people would know how to read it, it would make all the difference in the world. But I don't know if people bother that much. So you need a Rebbe. Number five. God says to Moshe, before Jews go out of Mitzrayim, I want them to ask for garments, gold, silver, shmatas. And the pasuk there says, "V'natati etchem ha'am hazeh be'ein Mitzrayim." I'm going to give the favor of the people in the eyes of Egypt, when you're going to leave, lo telchurei kom, you're not going to go empty-handed. V'sho'alo, that word, v'sho'alo isha mishchenta, then every woman shall ask of her neighbor, umigorat beita, and from the one that lives in her house, klei chesed, klei tzov, silver and gold, smalot, and garments, v'santem, and you should put them on b'necha, on b'necha, you know, take all you can and put it on your sons and your daughters. Then Mitzaltem and Mitzrayim, and you should divest Mitzrayim, leave Mitzrayim empty. V'shalom. What does V'shalom mean? So many make the mistake of thinking that V'shalom means to borrow. Borrow, there's a big difference between asking and borrowing. Borrowing means that I intend to pay back. I'll bring it back to you. Okay? So if you read the Shalom and interpret it as meaning to borrow, We have a serious moral problem starting with God and everybody else. They're pulling a fist when I'm all of Egypt. Everybody's lying, and the one who told them to lie is God. So take a look at what here also Rav Shamshon of Frohersh has to say. This word has an unfortunate history. The word Vishala has an unfortunate history. It occurs at least a few hundred times in Tanakh, and there it always has the meaning to demand, to request, to obtain by entreaty, never to borrow. It never means to borrow. There happens to be only one place in all of Tanakh, from the beginning of Bereshis until the end of Dereyam, only one place where it means, in a sense, to borrow. So in other words, we forget about hundreds of times where it means to ask, okay? And we say, no, it means to borrow. Watch. In one single instant alone is it used for borrowing. And you know where that single instant is? In this passage, Pashim Shpotin, V'chiyishal ish me'im reyehu, if a person is going to borrow from his friend an animal or implements, so there's the whole halacha of a shoel. A shoel became the term for somebody who borrows. And this one single instant, because it just happens to describe a legal relationship, and in consequence the word shoel has become current in all laws referring to a borrower. The borrower is called a shoel, and it's of everyday use, has been cause of people seeing in the expression shoela here at once, we identify it with the idea to borrow, but that's not the meaning of the word shoela here. Shoela does not mean borrow. If anybody remembers the shiur that I once gave on this, not halacha, it can be more than that. God asks Moshe, please Moshe, ask the people to ask for money and silver and garments. And I asked, why does God have to beg Moshe? Please ask them to ask. So I explained, but why didn't God simply say, "The bear of the nation speak unto the children of Israel, command them to ask for gold and silver"? Because there's something extremely significant about the slave, the one who's been enslaved for who knows how many years, to walk over to his next door neighbor, the taskmaster. I want gold and silver. You know what he's saying? He's saying, I worked for you for 200 years. You owe me. I'm not begging. I'm not borrowing. You know what the Rebbeinu wants? The Rebbeinu wants that the last act that Jews do on their way out of Mitzrayim is they're going to turn enslavement into employment. No Jew should ever have to look back and think, they enslaved us for all those years. How did we let them get away with it? What the Rebbeinu wants should happen is a complete change of an emotional nature by Klal Yisrael. To be able to stand up to the taskmaster and say to him, Habibi, you owe me. That's what God wanted. Oh no, we're not playing games anymore. We don't just want to empty Mitzrayim and we're going to use the subterfuge. I'm going to borrow it. Oh, you know, we're going to wait. We're going for 3 days. Understand? And meanwhile, put garments on your children again, like you've gone through Meches over there in Ben Gurion Airport. No, that's not what it's all about. There was something that truly important over here, and the word Vishalom means to ask. The word Vishala means to demand. The word Vishala means to stand there in the fullness of a new born personality of a free man. Give a hair, Habibi. Give a hair. You took from me for 200 years. You sucked the marrow out of my bones. Let's go. The word Vishala does not mean to borrow. The word v'shala means what it means in every other case in all of the world. That's how you're supposed to read and understand the word. And incidentally, what Rav Shamshon Lefel Hirsch said about Torah in general, that all of this Moshe Rabbeinu taught them. They learned all of Torah before it was given to them at the end. They knew exactly what the word v'shala means. They had no doubt about it. I'm going to leave you hanging. I'm going to leave you suspended. On this, I don't know what the circumstances will be, but to be continued. You know, all those people out there that are watching this video on OU or on RabbiSharonGold.com, we'll get back to it at some point. I'm not sure when. We'll have something else for next week. But all right, we'll find a way. Okay, so, yes.